From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for listening to us today. We're talking about a very important issue in our greater community, and that is access to affordable housing, housing insecurity, discrimination in the housing processes. These are things that we've talked about before on Newsmakers, and we have a couple of guests who are eager to share some information with us today and tell you a little bit more about some presentations that are going to be available to the public, and we'll learn more about that later. But first, let me welcome our guests. First of all, Charlotte Peters is the community development educator at Extension La Crosse County. Charlotte, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Natalie Hennigan is also here, who is the community outreach director at Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse area. Natalie, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thanks for having us.
So the topic of the day, basically, I know I'm shortening it a little bit, housing insecurity. And where that comes from is a presentation that you are going to be part of on two different occasions at the La Crosse Public Library called Then and Now, Housing Access, Insecurity, and Discrimination. And that's going to be on April 16th and 17th. We'll give some more information about that as the program goes on. But Natalie, why don't we start with you and just describe for people what you're talking about when we talk about housing insecurity. What is that?
Sure. So here at Habitat for Humanity, we know we are living in a pretty serious housing crisis, but we also know this isn't the first time that La Crosse nor any community across the country has experienced a housing crisis. So what that means is that too many people in our community can't find housing that fits their needs. They can't find housing that is safe, that is affordable, that is accessible to them. And this runs the spectrum from people who are experiencing homelessness to people who can't find that affordable starter home that they want to purchase and start building equity. So the focus of this program is to really look back at our past to better understand how we got to this current housing crisis and how we can work to remedy it.
It seems like a lot of people could really should be able to relate to that feeling. You're housing insecurity certainly includes people who literally have no shelter, but it's not limited to that. You're talking about people all the way up the spectrum to people who maybe even are in a house, a long-term rental situation, maybe even a house that they own, but they're not really even sure how they're going to stay in that because maybe payments have gotten away from them, or maybe there's been a job loss or some other kind of financial crisis in their family. This is a thing that affects a lot of people, isn't it?
Absolutely. And one of the things we look at in this presentation is how rapidly costs have risen in recent years. And we're not just talking, you know, since the pandemic, since really the Great Recession, housing costs, the cost of construction, the cost of labor and materials, and the limited supply, we're simply building fewer homes than we were before 2007, 2008. So it's really strapping our communities with too few options and leaving people only, you know, able to choose between a couple extremely expensive or out of reach options.
Charlotte, is this primarily a conversation about home ownership? I know a lot of people talk about how much harder it is for members of the younger generation to actually purchase homes than their parents and grandparents did. But also, it's not just home loans that are becoming less accessible. Rent is absolutely skyrocketing as well, isn't it?
Yes. And I think a lot of the conversation kind of relates to that as far as, you know, the fact that wages are simply just not keeping up. And families, if you have a family of four, it's really difficult to, you know, have that extra income to put aside for your down payment on your house and things like that. You know, and looking at the cost of food and the cost of childcare and the cost of just daily life, as opposed to having that expendable or having income that you can set aside for the big expenses.
So what do we know about the let's just talk about home ownership for starters. What do we know about home ownership in the greater La Crosse area. I don't know how you want to, how far out from that from that center you want to go. Is home ownership actually decreasing from previous generations, or what's the comparison sort of now versus then?
Yeah, statistically, you know, looking at census data and things like that, you can see the decrease in home ownership. You can also see the decrease in single family homes that are available. The housing stock in this area is aging, and it's not, and there's just the density, there's a density issue. So there's really no way to build a lot of new housing because there's no place to put it. You know, and then the people that there's way more people here that are looking for single family instead of like a duplex or a triplex where you own it, but you know, it's the density is there so that more families can have that opportunity.
So what is the population in like, are these inventory issues related to population growth, or what causes that lack of availability of housing?
Not really. I think it's more of just a stagnation. And as many people are buying houses, they aren't selling them. You know, we do have an aging population here in the city of La Crosse, but again, they're in their homes and they're not moving on to other things. They're not moving away or moving to a smaller house. They're not downsizing. And a lot of that comes from there's no place for them to downsize to, and they can't afford to downsize because the cost of a smaller house may still outweigh the equity that they have in the house that they currently own just because of the way the market has fluctuated with housing. You know, I don't think it's the overall growth for La Crosse County as a whole isn't that much, but the housing that is available is still not meeting those needs.
Natalie, when I first read about this presentation, it reminded me of a conversation that I had a couple of months ago. Some people were here from the La Crosse County Historical Society, and were talking about a project that they're involved in called the Enduring Families Project, which portrays the historical accounts of Black people who lived in the La Crosse area in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And one of the things that was commented on during that episode of Newsmakers was that there was talk about potentially La Crosse having a reputation as a sundown town way back in the day. And I was really interested to see that mentioned in the information that you sent to me about this upcoming presentation, because that's one of the things you talk about is La Crosse's history as a sundown town. Tell our listeners who might not know what is meant by that term, sundown town.
Sure. So a sundown town is a term used to describe communities that effectively did not allow Black folks to stay in their community past sundown. So they might be able to come into a particular city or community for a job during the day, but they by no means could be found after dark in that town, or they would be violently forced out by a number of means. And there were many ways that communities enforced that sort of policy, so to speak. You might typically see an example of a sign, you know, on a city limit saying, you know, no Negroes after dark, for example, or after sundown. In La Crosse, we don't have hard evidence of something that tangible or specific. But one of Charlotte's and my collaborators, Jenny DeRocher, an archivist at the La Crosse Public Library, her research in past years has confirmed that La Crosse indeed was a sundown town because of numerous other reasons, explicit threats towards Black folks living in our community, presence of the KKK, things like this. And we demonstrate and we show some of this evidence from the public library's archives during this presentation, because, you know, housing, access to housing is not created equal. Not everybody experiences it the same way. There are class and race issues that we need to be layering into this conversation to ensure people understand that not everybody's, ways to finding a home, whatever that means to them, are the same. And oftentimes, in fact, most cases, your race plays a huge part in that.
It's interesting to think about because we would assume that we're looking for those explicit signs, like the literal sign you mentioned that you would encounter going into some towns about who could be there when, things like that. But less explicit signs, these dog whistles, these kind of they're not explicitly stated, you know, this population isn't welcome, but it's the way you put in like neighborhood covenants, for example, or, you know, certain kinds of city ordinances, those kinds of things that have a big that send a big message if you're the kind of person who has to listen for that message in order to stay safe.
Absolutely. And you bring up racially restrictive covenants, which is a huge was a hugely powerful tool in keeping Black families from homeownership. This being a clause inserted into your property deed that said effectively no one who isn't white can own this property. And these started to crop up in property deeds from, you know, the 19 teens through even past 1948 when they were actually deemed unenforceable. We still see them into the 50s. And Charlotte has actually in her research found evidence of racially restrictive covenants covering entire neighborhoods of La Crosse that said no house that's going to be built in this entire development could be sold to a Black family. So that gets pretty explicit there too, that we're transferring property ownership from white family to white family and excluding anybody who is not white from taking part in the benefits of home ownership.
Charlotte, tell me about that. How do you even go about uncovering that information?
You sit and you read a lot of deeds and then track down the covenants that go along with those deeds. I was lucky enough to have access to the system here at the county to kind of be able to go and look through past deeds and covenants based on location. You know, I could type in an address because we knew of certain areas in the city of La Crosse where housing developments were being made. And then you can see the historical documents that go along with the setting up of, you know, the neighborhoods and things like that. So, you know, and it takes hours and hours to look through these documents. So unfortunately, there's no quick scan to do that. So you actually have to read each document.
Well, certainly in modern times, any kind of redlining like that is supposed to be illegal. Natalie, what kinds of housing discrimination are people facing now? What does that look like in this era? How do people get away with it?
Sure. Well, and maybe I'll make two points. And first, that these you know, now illegal tools of discrimination have a lasting impact, of course. And so it wasn't more than two generations ago that it would still be legal to have a racially restrictive covenant or something like that added to your property deed. And we know about the generational wealth that's developed from homeownership, and that just was not a benefit extended to families who weren't white for the most part. And yes, as you're saying, you know, there are now contemporary tools that are perhaps even less explicit, a little more subtle. We actually have some colleagues presenting at our program next week about modern day experiences of people seeking mortgages who are rejected for a variety of reasons. Maybe they happen to work at their parents' business. And for somebody who isn't white, that was seen as not a trusting source of employment, not worthy enough to extend a mortgage to, or folks whose names, their last names are clearly not, you know, maybe they are clearly Vietnamese or something like that. And people's implicit biases sort of kick in there and or explicit perhaps and start to make choices about who is worthy of a mortgage or not based on what we, you know, our stereotypes that exist for folks of different races or ethnicities. So there's numerous examples of people still being denied a mortgage. And I know there are also studies that have been done, you know, tests where, say, a Black family is seeking a home in a neighborhood and they go in with a realtor and the same white family with the same, or a white family with the same, you know, credit score, the same savings, the same, you know, types of jobs go in, and they are showed entirely different homes in entirely different neighborhoods that are seen, you know, perhaps more affluent or more white. And so we know these things are still happening, you know, perpetuated by, you know, sort of the normal ways we go about doing the work of real estate. So it's interesting. It still happens, despite it being somewhat subtle in many cases.
Wow. It's astounding that people still think that they and that they still do get away with that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So let's talk about since a lot of people that are just coming into the idea of, you know, living on their own, maybe they're trying to get their, you know, first apartment, and they, you know, they don't have the credit check is going to be a problem for them or something like that. Or maybe they have been on their own for a little while and are trying to buy their first house. Obviously the deck is potentially stacked against people just trying to get into affordable housing at the moment. Are there financial skills and strategies, though, that people can learn that will help them get farther down the road and might help kind of push them beyond that boundary?
That's a really good question that both Charlotte and I are kind of saying, maybe talk to a financial expert.
I mean, I could speak from personal experience that, renting that first apartment or moving from one state to another state and getting all of your ducks in a row to be able to rent an apartment can be a nightmare if you don't have, you know, everything right in order. It's easier now than it used to be only because things are more electronic. Mm-hmm. But, you know, yeah, there's, as far as getting that first apartment, no, not really. I think, you know, one of the big things that comes into play for especially a lot of younger people is you have to have a co-signer. And if your parents aren't, you know, in that window of opportunity to be able to even do that, or don't have the credit that you would need to be a backup on your child's lease agreement and things like that, it can get really difficult. You can have a really hard time getting your first apartment just simply because you're supposed to have established credit and all of these things for a first apartment, you know, and there's no way as a child, you know, an 18, 19, 20 year old, it's very, very difficult to establish credit.
I'm a Gen Xer, and my parents are boomers. I can see their perspective easily. I can see the perspective of the younger generation. My young brother is part of a much, much younger generation than me. And so I get both of these perspectives, and I can hear my parents' voices in my head saying, some of these people expect everything to just be handed to them. And they, you know, here they are complaining about a lack of access to financial means and whatever, but they're door dashing dinner every night, and they're, you know, all these things that are maybe not the most responsible decisions, et cetera. How do we get people to understand that this issue is bigger than whether somebody eats out slightly too often?
I was going to say than not going to Starbucks every morning for a cup of coffee.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can understand why, like, you'd want to get a young person and say, look, this is not a good idea if you want to get ahead in life. On the other hand, like, making those small adjustments is most likely not going to be the difference between somebody being able to afford an apartment or not.
Right. And I think, you know, that's something to keep in mind too. When I was in my 20s, you know, what was a gallon of milk? A gallon of milk was under $1, you know, and now it's like $3 to $4, depending on what kind of milk you buy and what store you're shopping at. I think just getting people to understand that the actual cost of living and the simple fact that our wages aren't keeping up with the cost of living is going to have an impact on where people can live and how they choose to live. You know, if you've got a roof over your head, and the one thing that gives you a little bit of joy every day is stopping to get a $3 cup of coffee, and you can afford it, you know, that $3 cup of coffee is not keeping you from a $300,000 starter home.
Right.
You know? And I think that's the, the big misconception, I know my parents are also of the boomer generation or silent generation, actually. You know, their first house was $36,000 for a house.
Yeah.
And it was a 3-bedroom house with a full basement and a huge yard, you know, and getting them to understand that I pay a month for my health insurance twice as much to 3 times as much as they used to pay for their first house payment.
Yeah.
You know, and that my insurance doesn't cover the same things their insurance covers, so that I have to have that backup if I want to do any doctoring, because, you know, there's expenses above what I'm supposed to pay. So, you know, getting people to just understand that it's not the same. It's the money is the same because people are still making the same thing that we made 20 years ago, you know, but it doesn't go the distance that it used to go. And you can't just walk into your neighborhood bank and say, I'd like a $36,000 to buy, or, you know, loan to buy a house, because it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
There's all these other things that come into play now, other than just knowing that Don at the local bank is going to give me a loan because he knows my dad, he knows my grandparents, and he knows everybody else in my family. That doesn't happen now.
The income piece that you mentioned, Charlotte, is so important because you talked about that home that your parents bought for like $36,000 or whatever it was, and somebody's going to come back and say, oh, yes, well, of course that costs more now. It's 50 years later, so inflation has had an effect. And obviously a home 50 years ago would cost less than it does now. But the problem is, isn't it, that wages have not risen at the same rate that all the other stuff has risen?
Correct. Correct. You know, I mean, just look at your minimum wage. Minimum wage was established to help fight inflation and to keep up with the cost of living. And as things got more expensive, minimum wage was also supposed to go up to combat that and to make life more stable for everybody involved, you know, and minimum wage doesn't change. It just stays the same. And yes, now we have some push to change minimum wage and things like that, but you still have people making $8 an hour. You know, think about making $8 an hour and having $900 a month rent for a little 2-bedroom apartment or a 1-bedroom apartment even. You know, how do you balance that? I make $8 a month, an hour. I work 40 hours a week or more because I'm going to have 2 jobs if I actually want to pay rent and eat, mm-hmm. you know, and you can't afford a base apartment that's $900 a month, you know, and the average apartment in La Crosse County is between $800 and $900 a month. And that's just for a small apartment. That's not a 2 or 3-bedroom apartment where you could have a family with a couple of kids and, you know, moderate income of, you know, of a working couple or anything like that. So yeah, it's saying that, well, yeah, of course everything costs more. Well, then everything else should go up in line with that. And wages are simply just not doing that.
Well, I feel like we're just getting into what's a very important issue. And it's a good thing that the conversation doesn't have to stop here. In fact, it continues. There's a much greater amount of time allotted to it on Tuesday, April 16th and Wednesday, April 17th, when you are giving a presentation, Then and Now, Housing Access, Insecurity, and Discrimination. And that presentation is going to be at the La Crosse Public Library Main Branch. And Natalie, what else do people need to know about that?
Yeah, it's going to be a great conversation. It's going to be a little interactive. So come prepared to reflect and ask some questions of yourselves and the people around you. Get prepared to have conversations with people around you. But it's really intended for anybody interested in digging deeper into this conversation. There's been a great response so far, and we're really looking forward to having a positive conversation and sending people away with some ideas for how they can get a little bit more engaged in what's going on in La Crosse too.
And is that two versions of the same presentation, or are people meant to attend both of them?
That's right. It's 2 versions of the same presentation, different times, different days to allow for more folks to attend.
Okay. And where can people find more information about it?
You can go to habitatlacrosse.org. And our events page, the 2 events should pop right up there. We've also been promoting it on our social media, on Facebook and Instagram, Habitat La Crosse.
Natalie Hennigan is the Community Outreach Director for Habitat for Humanity of the Greater La Crosse area. Natalie, thanks a lot for being on Newsmakers today.
Thank you so much.
And Charlotte Peters is a Community Development Educator with Extension La Crosse County. Charlotte, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you very much.
I'm Ezra Wall. This is Newsmakers. If you'd like to email our show, you can do that by sending it to newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Our program continues after this here on Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, it's Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studios on the campus of UW-La Crosse. We're talking about housing security today. Earlier in the show, you heard some information about just how expensive it is to find a place to live. The idea of affordable housing just isn't a reality for so many people in our listening area. And we're talking to another organization now that comes in contact with people every single day who are facing that reality. We're talking with a couple of people affiliated with The Exchange, a La Crosse Area Furniture Bank, and we're going to find out more about that outfit, as well as its parent organization, Shelter Development. And joining us is the Executive Director of Shelter Development, Ben Hine. Ben, thank you for joining us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you for having us, Ezra.
With Ben is Sarah Gibo. Sarah is the Program Director of The Exchange. Sarah, thanks a lot for being here.
We're excited to be here. Thank you.
So let me talk to you. First of all, Sarah, The Exchange, La Crosse Area Furniture Bank. We've heard about a food bank. Is a furniture bank a similar concept?
It's a very similar concept. So basically, we open up to the community for donations to come in, and we give them away to community members who are in need. Very similar.
Okay. So how many clients do you serve in a period of time, a month, a year? How many people come through your doors?
Well, last year, 2023, we served over 520 households. A household could be anywhere from a single person to a family. The largest household we served last year was 11 people, two adults and nine children.
Wow.
Ranging in the ages from a toddler to a high school student. The folks that we have coming in are working with about 30 different organizations. So we're working with about 30 different organizations to bring them in.
Okay. People are working through different social service organizations who know about you and find you. Is there ever a person who just like comes in out of the blue and says, "Hey, I need help"? What happens if somebody does that?
Sure. Yeah. Someone might just come and knock on the door, and we have a list of the regular organizations that we work with. Different organizations have different niches. So some organization might have more work with aging and disability. Some might be more domestic abuse, and some might be more mental issues. Mostly the clients that are coming in, overall commonality is low income. So if someone comes in and knocks on that door, we can get them connected with an organization. And from that point, once they have someone to advocate on their behalf, that person will contact us. The advocates, these organizations, what they do is they assess the need for these families, what their needs are, how we can help, and then they come to us. We don't actually ask questions. We don't do screening. We just say yes when the organization says, "I have a family. They need some beds. Can we make an appointment?" And that's how we work.
Okay. You mentioned a family might need some beds. What is the most in-demand item? Is it beds or chairs, or what are people looking for the most?
What we do here is the needs, the functionality pieces. Beds are an essential item for anybody to have a good night's sleep, to be productive during the day at work or at school. So beds are the hardest to come by. We here at the warehouse accept twin size, full size, and queen size mattresses that are clean, stain-free, rip-free, odor-free. Along with that, we do accept the box springs and the metal frames. We are limited in our warehouse space, so we are very selective of what we take in, making sure that everything is clean and fully functioning.
Hmm. So, Ben, tell me about the beginnings of the exchange. I know you're the executive director of Shelter Development, and we can talk about those beginnings in a moment. But how did the exchange, how did the idea for that come up, and how did you get involved?
Sure. The exchange is a relatively young social service agency here in the La Crosse area. In 2016, a dedicated group of community volunteers identified that there was a need for a furniture bank, that there were individuals in our community that, though they may have more formal social service supports with regards to the areas that Sarah mentioned, aging, disability, homelessness, experiencing domestic violence, there was a need or a gap in the community for a mechanism to convene those household items that all families need. So in 2016, the founders of the exchange started out in rental space very modestly. And over the last several years, we've grown into our own agency building and warehouse here on 4th Street in La Crosse. In 2016, I believe the agency served 15 households. And since that time, the services and the partnerships within the community have really increased to the point, as Sarah mentioned, where we're now serving well over 500 households annually.
From 15 to hundreds in just not quite 10 years. That's pretty amazing.
It is. There's certainly a need within the community, and we appreciate the partnerships and the collaboration from all the different, we call them advocate agencies, who refer households that they're already working with to the exchange. That collaboration is, I think, a real key term or phrase with in anything that the exchange does. We're collaborative with the donors who are donating their household items, collaborative with the partner agencies who are referring families over to receive our services.
It seems like the affordable housing is almost an oxymoron now. It really is something that's harder and harder to come by. The increase in your ability to serve people, is that because, Sarah, is that because your actual capacity as an organization has increased, or how much of it is due to the fact that more and more people actually need services like yours?
Well, I believe it's due to our expansion within the community's involvement and commitment to supporting us in providing these needs. As far as housing goes, I don't know if there's a straight correlation. I will say that it certainly is the largest problem people are facing. Families who might be out of home because of a job loss. And a lot of these families that are, experiencing trying to get into a new housing, they work two jobs, they have kids in school, but they just can't simply get to the point where they can make that down payment, last month's rent, and, which ends up being a few thousand dollars right off the bat while they're still trying to, get winter boots for their kids and food on the table.
Yeah, it's an insane amount of money to come up with when you think about renting a space of less than 1,000 square feet. I mean, an 800 square foot apartment is going to cost $1,000 a month or something like that. It's ridiculous.
Well, easily, and right now I'd say it's even upwards of 1,200.
Yeah,
and that's not including electricity. That's not including gas, lights, all that jazz.
Yeah. So and then you get in that space and all of a sudden, where's everybody going to sleep? And we don't have a kitchen table or whatever. Where do the items that you're providing for people, where do those items come from? I know the public can donate. Tell me how you make those arrangements.
The website is the easiest way to get in contact with us. There's a lot of information and guidelines on what we do accept, what sizes, what limitations we may have in items. The email is right there. Send us an email and we will get the process started. In addition to individual donors, we have some larger donors as well that we have worked with. PM Sleep Center is a great source for beds, Ashley Furniture. There's quite a few programs out there that instead, you know, that may have beds, for example, in bulk, and instead of taking it to the dump, they will give us the opportunity to utilize them and rehome them first. So if anybody is looking to donate items, give us an email or give us a call and we will get the process started.
It's always interesting to me when I've talked in various points in my career. I'm not necessarily talking about somebody locally here, but I've talked to people either from a food bank about what they get too much of or what they don't want any more of, or from shelters that, you know, they want this kind of clothing is really helpful and this not so much because everybody tries to give us, you know, their old worn out stuff or whatever. Furniture, you talked about what condition mattresses have to be to donate. What in other areas of furniture, are there things that you just don't need or just don't want that people are frequently trying to give you?
Absolutely. What I tell folks is if you wouldn't give it to your best friend, then we wouldn't want to give it to someone in need. Large furniture items, you know, sectional couches, sofa sleepers, those are too big and too bulky. If you think about the La Crosse area specifically, a lot of these older homes have been converted into duplexes or triplexes. And the bedrooms are small, the stairways are narrow to get furniture in. So the smaller apartment style furniture is more conducive to the needs of our organization. Make sure that everything is in working order. You know, we don't fix furniture here. We aren't restoring it. We are taking it in and it's going out pretty much in the same fashion that it came in. So if it's trash, it's trash. It needs to be quality items that you would give to your friend or family.
Yeah. There's a difference between, I mean, everybody wants to support a charitable organization, but there's a difference between charity and spring cleaning, right?
If it's, there sure is.
If it's yeah. Spring cleaning, you know, take it, put it out on large item day. Like nobody wants that.
No.
So who qualifies to be, you talked about you don't do actual qualifying of the clients that you serve. You depend on other organizations to do that. How many organizations did you say you work with?
Well, we're over 30.
Wow.
Over 30 organizations. And no, we don't do this training. We depend on advocates to do that. The exchange is volunteer run. We have two part-time employees right here that are directly working at the exchange. And then we have Ben, who is part-time, who is coming from shelter development and not overhead. So we depend upon the volunteer community to make things work. We're not social workers. Our volunteer base commits their time, their energy, their vehicles to helping us out. Currently, we have almost 70 volunteers that are here on a regular basis making this operation work.
That's amazing.
It's incredible.
Generosity in action is a phrase that keeps coming to mind when I think about the exchange, Ezra, just to see the generosity of community donors who are providing inventory for neighbors in need who don't have those household items, and then the generosity of our volunteer team that is by and large doing the work of the agency, from receiving those donations to moving and delivering that furniture, to meeting with clients and advocates as they come through for their appointment to select items. It's just all of those different pieces of generosity contribute into a service that I think is very well-rounded for everyone involved.
It's really amazing. So I want to find out about more about shelter development, Ben. It's the parent organization, so to speak, of the exchange, and it also is not an old organization, as I'm reading information about it on your website. Tell me about shelter development. What the purpose of that organization is.
Sure. As you mentioned, Shelter Development was founded in 2016 as a nonprofit charitable organization. And within the larger shelter development organizations, we have two programs, the work of the exchange, across Community Furniture Bank, and also, which is very visible to the public and I think well-known because of the different points of contact that individuals in the community may have with the exchange. either someone who may be receiving services or offering their donation of time or donation of furniture. The second piece of our shelter development agency is a housing program called Francis Homes Program, where the agency, a much smaller scale program, not as public facing, but a program in which the agency owns several rental properties and works with families who may be facing housing instability, may have experienced periods of homelessness. And we partner with other housing or social service providers who essentially serve as the supportive case management piece for the families who are residing in Francis Homes.
Okay, they're rental properties, but they're not are these houses that are specifically designed not to be like the astronomical, like you can't possibly afford this sort of thing, or how what makes that a charitable operation?
Well, our goal is to make sure that families have sustainability moving forward. So the Francis Homes are offered what you would consider reduced from that fair market rent, just by the charitable nature mm-hmm. of the agency and the program, with the goal that in working with the supportive case manager that family will gain some stability and some independence in housing in the future.
Okay. And is that a scalable program at all? Do you see that program growing as the need continues to be present in our community?
That's a good question, Ezra. And I think that there definitely is a need. I think people familiar with social service in La Crosse identify that there's a lot of work being done at a larger, more community-based level to address housing insecurity and homelessness mm-hmm. throughout the community. So I really think it's a combination of different programs offering their own support and their own structure that may really move the needle towards providing some housing stability to families at high risk. But there certainly is a need, and I think opportunity to continue to scale and increase programs like Francis Homes.
I know that reduction in homelessness is part of why you do what you do. It says so in your organization's published information, but it's such a vast problem. I'm wondering how as a leader of a small-ish organization, like how do you decide which part of that your organization can contribute to tackling?
I think you bring up an important point there, that each program needs to really fine tune on their own aspect of expertise in providing support for people in need, and then also reach out and have a collaborative nature, pull additional experts into that programming. I think both Francis Homes and the Exchange have done a good job of that, of really working in partnership with other groups that are providing that support. And in that way, each of those different programs can magnify their impact.
Ben, tell me what got you interested in this kind of work? What prepared you for it? Have you always been in nonprofit work?
I have worked in social service for about the last 20 years. I think what really drew me to shelter development and working with the Exchange and Francis Homes team is definitely that collaborative nature that we have here. And as I mentioned before, I just really keep coming back to that generosity and action. It inspires me personally and professionally to see the dedicated group of volunteers that work in the Exchange every day, make the program run, operate smoothly, and the impact that they can have on people's lives that are coming through. And quite frankly, they're coming to our service because they're experiencing a very rough period in their lives, or going through hardship and trying to navigate all the challenges that come along with that. So I'm personally inspired just by the compassionate nature with which the Exchange volunteers deliver the service, and the attention that they pay to other people's needs, people that, you know, maybe 5 to 10 minutes previously had been strangers. So I personally take away a lot from that, and that motivates me to really enjoy working in this field and supporting that team.
Sarah, what about you? What background brings you into this work?
You know, I was in hospitality for 25 years. And when COVID hit and I was forced to take a break, I started volunteering at the exchange a couple times a week. And I was talking with the original coordinators and they said, how do I get paid for this? And they said, well, you know, we're restructuring. Shelter Development is restructuring and we're looking at starting some paid-time staff. And I said, sign me up.
So it started, you were interested in the program already because you were volunteering in it.
I was volunteering. I had a piece of furniture. I had a couch that I wanted to donate somewhere and I didn't want it, you know, to be sold. I wanted to go to direct to family and mm-hmm. I found the exchange and that is the service to direct to families.
Wow. So what is, talk about that difference. You said you came from hospitality and that is certain people who are sort of called into that sort of profession, service is important to them in a certain way as well. But what's that switch been like going from hospitality into this charitable sector where you like immediately see the impact of the work that you're doing on people?
Well, it's been a really neat transition for sure. Similarities between both is learning how to read people. When folks come into the exchange, they're coming oftentimes from a very insecure place, being overwhelmed, you know, having all the thoughts in their head of what am I doing next? What am I going to, how am I going to provide for my kids? How am I going to get them to school? Did my car break down? Do I have a home for more than a month? So with all that overwhelming sensation and emotions that are going through their heads, we have, you know, we read them. We take the time to listen and adjust how we approach folks depending upon, you know, the background and transitions that they're going through. So it's the people skills. It's learning to read people, read emotions. And, you know, I'll tell you what, people leave here happy. And the biggest reward is certainly, you know, the hugs at the end.
Mm. That's wonderful. Well, if people are interested in knowing how they can help the exchange, if they have furniture, if they want to help out as a volunteer, Ben, how should people reach out to get in touch?
We appreciate everyone looking into the program and taking an interest in the service that we're providing here at the exchange. And I would definitely encourage them to check out our agency website. You search for the Exchange La Crosse, the agency website will come up and you can learn a lot more about the types of items that we receive, the needs that the program has for families experiencing hardships and all the different ways to contact and communicate with our team to learn more.
Ben Hine is the executive director of Shelter Development, which is the parent organization of the Exchange La Crosse Area Furniture Bank. And Sarah Gibo is the program director of the Exchange. Thank you both for joining us today on Newsmakers. This has been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you for the opportunity to share with our community and giving us a larger voice.
Thank you, Ezra. We appreciate it.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you've missed part of our show today and you want to hear it again, you can find this episode and all the others at WPR.org/newsmakers. There are a couple of opportunities to hear us every week. We're on Friday morning at 10 on the Ideas Network, 90.3. We're on Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music, 88.9. And of course, we're always online at WPR.org. Until next time, I'm Ezra Wall. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.